This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk. My guest is Steve Hamilton, author of The Second Life of Nick Mason. Listeners might be familiar with his mystery series featuring Alex McKnight. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
After 10 books in a series featuring a Michigan ex-cop private investigator, why have you written the first in a new series about Nick Mason, a man on the other side of the law?
Well, after doing 10 books in that series, it just felt like it was time to do something totally different. It's the same kind of feeling I had once before when I took a break from that series to write a book called The Lock Artist. And that was about a young safecracker. And the character was so much different, and the story was so much different, that it was a new kind of challenge for me as a writer. And it made me better when I went back to the Alex McKnight series. So it's always good to take a step away and try something different.
Is the Alex McKnight series over?
No, it most definitely is not. As a matter of fact, I'm just about to turn in number 11 in that series. And I hope if you like that series, if anybody listening knows that series and they like it, that they'll like Nick Mason just as much. In some future book, these two characters will actually come together in the same book.
When did Nick's as a concept start with you?
When I was starting to think about what this new character would be, I was working with a screenwriter and producer named Shane Salerno, who wrote one of the Avatar sequels, is adapting The Cartel, the great Don Winslow book from last year. And he's also my agent now, too. So we have a very close relationship, and he has such a great story sense that he was able just to sort of be a good sounding board to drop to some bounce some ideas back and forth, and a couple of those ideas just sort of came together, and we came up with this character who is in this impossible situation in his life when he's in prison for a long time. There's no getting out. Someone makes him an offer that will get him out, and he'll be able to see his family again. So he takes it. He has to take it. And not only does he get out, but the next day he walks into a whole new life. Because now all of a sudden he's living in this amazing townhouse and driving this amazing car, and he has money every month. It's just everything a man could want, seemingly. And yet the cost of this deal that he's made, this devil's bargain, is that whenever the phone rings, he has to answer it. And he has to do exactly what he's told to do. No matter what it is, no matter what crime he has to commit, no matter what horrible thing he has to go out and do, that's the deal that he made, and there is no way out of it.
What's this bona fide criminal's loveliest quality still?
He does all this because he wants to see his daughter. You know, he wants to see his ex-wife, if that's possible, but more than anything, he has a 9-year-old daughter. And he's been in prison for 5 years, so he's missed most of her life. And that's the thing that drives him the most. And I think that's something that anybody could relate to. You know, whether he's a criminal or not, that's something that would drive me if I was in prison for whatever reason.
In your book, there's a Chicago Police Department called the SIS Division.
Yeah.
And that was modeled on the real Chicago Special Operations Section?
The real SOS, yeah. I sort of envisioned this crew of corrupt cops in this book, and I started looking into Chicago's real-life history, and you don't have to go back far at all. You go back 10 years, and you find this real-life task force that was called SOS. And it's just amazing what happened with these guys. I mean, and this really happened. They were put together, and they were given this absolute power to go anywhere in the city that they wanted to, just to take guns off the street, drugs off the street, however they could do it. And they got some really good numbers at first, so they were encouraged to keep doing whatever they were doing. But it turns out they were holding up suspects. They were robbing them, taking them to their houses, and taking all their money. They were finally started just kidnapping them off the streets and torturing them. And towards the end, one of the ringleaders actually tried to put out a contract hit on another cop who was going to testify against him. So it's just all this crazy stuff that happened in real life. It was almost, you know, it was as bad as anything I could have imagined in a book. And in a book, at least, you get to make all these guys pay for it.
Right.
And in real life, it doesn't always work out that way.
There have been Chicago police scandals since.
There certainly have. I mean, it's for such a great city, and I was just there yesterday revisiting the city that I love so much. They do have this heartbreaking history of these scandals that sort of live, that thrive in this culture of secrecy. And it goes back, you know, goes back one scandal after another as you go back all the way to Al Capone.
Oh, that's right. He was from Chicago.
It sure was.
Your character, Darius Cole, is a crime kingpin running a maximum security prison while behind bars. For example, he managed to have Nick Mason not only released after 5 years of a 20-year sentence, but he had his conviction overturned.
Right.
Does this really happen in U.S. prisons?
Things like that happen. If you read about some of these major crime figures, you know, gang leaders, they go to prison, but their power is barely diminished because they still have contact with everyone in the outside world. And as long as you have that contact, you can make all these things happen. And I mean, there's this thriving market in black market cell phones, for instance, in a prison, which is a very important tool for a man like this to be able to reach out at any time and have the people who work for him still do whatever he needs to be done. And there are some prisons that are actually trying to block cell phone signals because it's so rampant, these black market phones.
So how can somebody who's a prisoner and behind bars do this?
If you have what it takes to get to this position in this terribly violent world and you get to this position of power, that means you have something really special about you. You have something really powerful. You know people. You know how to use people.
Like Darius.
Yeah, and so as he says himself, it's just a problem of geography. He's in this place now, but he's not in this place. He doesn't live there. This is a strange thing for a man serving two life sentences to say. I don't really live in this prison. This is just where I am now. I still live back in Chicago. And to him, it makes perfect sense.
He even lives in better quarters.
He does.
And is this possible in the real U.S.?
I'm sure. Yeah. It's these days, you know, it may not be quite as possible as it once was, and it's certainly not as possible as it is in other countries. You go to Mexico and you see El Chapo living in a, you know, pretty much a very luxurious, you know, cell. But it has happened, and I'm just, you know, I don't think it's a big stretch to imagine that someone with that much power could have some influence over the people who run the prison, or at least the corrections officers around him, that they would look the other way and let him take some, you know, have this or that other prisoners couldn't.
You pulled the plug on your old publisher 8 weeks before the publication date last year, and no doubt a scary move.
Scary is a mild term for it. It was absolutely terrifying, because I had left IBM at that point. For this book, for this series. And St. Martin's Press was the only publisher I'd ever had. I'd been there for 17 years. All 12 books, sold 1 million copies for them. They were my publisher. I was loyal to them. Even when we started this new deal, I said, let's go with them again. Because I wanted to do that. I wanted to stay. I wanted to be the one guy who stayed. Everybody, you know, all these other guys saying, why are you still there? I wanted to show them that there was a reason. Whether that was naive or not, that was my reasoning. And like you said, 8 weeks before the release date, with the books literally about to be printed the next day, we finally got a look at the marketing plan to see if they were going to keep any of these promises that they made about this time it's going to be different. You know, you get to go on a real tour this time. We're going to have national marketing and profiles and interviews. This is, you know, they were going to step up for me, finally, on this book, the beginning of this new series, and we believed in it so much. And we were so devastated to see just nothing in this plan that we just couldn't let this book go out there and die. We just couldn't do it. So we did the scariest thing of my life. We walked away and bought out the contract.
So you had a happy ending?
There were no guarantees it would be a happy ending.
I know!
But by the end of the day, 24 hours later, we had agreed to a new deal with Putnam.
Well, thank you. My guest is Steve Hamilton, author of The Second Life of Nick Mason, published by Putnam. This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk.